Before we go on, we need to find out how to develop this definiteness of purpose. There are some specific steps you'll need to take to embrace your own purpose. Napoleon Hill outlines them, beginning with putting your desires on paper.
Write out a clear statement of your major purpose in life, sign it, commit it to memory, and repeat it at least twice daily in the form of a prayer or affirmation. If you are married, have your mate sign the statement with you and repeat it together just before retiring each night. Write out a clear, definite outline of the plan or plans by which you intend to achieve the object of your definite major purpose, and state the maximum of time within which you intend to achieve it. Then describe in detail precisely what you intend to give in return for the realization of the object of your purpose, keeping in mind the fact that everything has a just price which must be paid. Keep your definite major purpose strictly to yourself and your mate in marriage. Call your definite major purpose into your conscious mind as often as may be practical. Eat with it, sleep with it, and take it with you every hour of the day, keeping in mind the fact that your subconscious mind can be influenced to work for its attainment while you sleep. Here is a very interesting case which shows what may happen when one neglects to move with definiteness of purpose. Some years ago, R.U. Darby from Baltimore, Maryland, had the good fortune to discover a very rich vein of gold while vacationing in the West. He went back home and borrowed money from friends and relatives with which to install mining machinery and went to work mining the rich gold ore. Now, all went well for a few weeks. Then suddenly the vein stopped. In sheer desperation, Darby sold the mining equipment to a junk dealer for a fraction of what it had cost, and he returned home. But the junk dealer proved himself smart by calling in a mining engineer who examined the mine, then announced that a fault in the earth had cut off the vein of ore. He said, "Dig ahead and you will pick up the vein again." The new owner, the man with definiteness of purpose, dug ahead just 3 feet and there picked up the vein again. His definiteness of purpose yielded him several millions of dollars. The mine turned out to be one of the richest in the West. And every day one sees men and women stopping just short of a glorious success because they are drifting through life without aim or purpose.
One true measure of high achievers is that of going the extra mile.
That means the rendering of more service and better service than one is paid to render, doing it in a pleasant mental attitude and doing it all the time. Well, now, here are some of the reasons why it pays to go the extra mile. First of all, it places the law of increasing returns back of one. Increasing returns. If it were not for the law of increasing returns, we'd all starve to death in a matter of months. The farmer takes advantage of that law of increasing returns, you know. He plows the ground, he harrows it, he fences it, and all of that costs money, but he gets nothing out of it. He has to do that in advance. And then he plants the seed in that soil at the right time of the year. He puts in a grain of wheat. He complies with nature's rules, all of which is going the extra mile. And then nature takes over from that point, and she brings him back that grain of wheat, plus 100 other grains to compensate him for his intelligence. Greatly multiplies what he does. If it were not for the fact that nature does work in this way, we'd all starve to death. In other words, if the farmer only put one grain of wheat in the ground and only got back one grain, there'd be no percentages in that. Nature recognizes the law of going the extra mile in everything we do and sees to it that you're compensated. There isn't a chance in this world of anybody doing anything to or for another person that isn't sooner or later done to or for him, greatly multiplied. It works out that way throughout life. Number two, it brings one to the favorable attention of those who can and do provide opportunities for self-promotion. I don't know of a single advantage that I have ever gained in life, that is a major advantage, that didn't come as a result of my going out of my way to do something for somebody else. I have never known an outstanding success in my life that didn't follow the habit of going the extra mile, of rendering more service than he was expected to render, and doing it in the right mental attitude. Third, It tends to permit one to become indispensable in many different human relationships, and therefore enables one to command more than the average compensation. The fellow who goes the extra mile, if he's working for a salary or for day wages or whatever he's working for, times get bad and they have to let off others. The man who's doing the employing never lets off the one who's going the extra mile until the very last, and it doesn't let him off at all unless he has to. He's the one that ensures himself a place. If the opportunities are being passed out, he has the choice of them because he has earned them in advance. Number four, it leads to mental growth and physical perfection in various forms of service, thereby developing greater ability and skill in one's chosen vocation. I can truthfully say that I have never delivered a lecture on this philosophy that I didn't intend to excel all other lectures on that subject that I ever delivered in my life, and that hasn't anything to do with the size of the audience or where I'm delivering it. I simply give the best that I have got every time I do it, because in the giving of the best, I become better for the next time. And it's only by that means that I have advanced to the point where I could hold large audiences for as long a time as I chose. Number five, it protects one against the loss of employment and places one in a position to choose his own job and working conditions and attracts new self-promotion opportunities. And six, it enables one to profit by the law of contrast, because the majority of people do not practice the habit, but follow its opposite by trying to get more than they are entitled to. The law of contrast is a great thing. I remember having that brought to my attention once when I walked down in front of Marshall Field and Company's show window. In one of those great show windows, there was a display of men's ties, nothing but men's ties. And in the center of this display was a dummy with a tie on, his collar all askew and the tie not straight, and it was not a good-looking tie, it was bad. And by the side of this dummy, there was a plain mirror, and when you walked up and looked at your own tie, the first thing you did was reach up there, and perhaps your collar wasn't straight and the tie didn't look just right. And you said, well, my gosh, my tie doesn't look as good as those inside, so you walk in and you buy half a dozen ties. The law of contrast. The man who made that window was a psychologist. He knew that by contrast, you would observe how much better the ties inside were than the one you had on. It made it very easy for you to make that observation by placing that mirror there. Number seven, going the extra mile leads to the development of a positive, pleasing mental attitude, which is among the more important traits of a pleasing personality. Now, you can't adopt the habit and follow it of going the extra mile without having a pleasing attitude toward other people. You just can't do it. And if you have a pleasing attitude toward others, they're going to reflect that same attitude back toward you. There's no question but what that works. You know that it works. Eight, it tends to develop a keen, alert imagination, because it is a habit which keeps one continuously seeking new and more efficient ways of rendering useful service. And nine, it develops the important factor of personal initiative. That is to say, going out and doing the thing without somebody telling you to do it. Without which no one may attain any position above mediocrity, and without which no one may acquire economic freedom. Personal initiative is the most outstanding trait of the typical successful American citizen, and this is a nation literally built upon personal initiative. When you get in the habit of going the extra mile, you'll find so many ways of creating opportunities for yourself. And one of the blessed things about it is you don't have to ask anybody's privilege of doing it. You can always find ways of doing something for somebody, and you don't even have to ask him whether you can do it or not. I never have yet heard of anybody becoming offended or mad at somebody that did something nice for him. Never have. Number 10, it definitely serves to develop self-reliance. Makes you feel good inside of your heart when you do something for another person that you wasn't expecting, with a surprise on his face. Does something to you and makes you feel that, after all, you're just a little bit out of the ordinary. You're thoughtful. Number 11, it serves also to build the confidence of others in your integrity and general ability. And 12, it aids you in mastering the destructive habit of procrastination, which is among the more common causes of failure in all walks of life. And 13, it develops definiteness of purpose without which no one can hope for success. And number 14, it is the only thing which gives one the right to ask for promotion or more pay. Do you see the significance of that? The majority of people, when they ask for a promotion or more pay, if they're working for wages or salary, they give about every other reason except the only logical and the only one that's sound, which is the fact that they have already established the policy of having gone the extra mile. That's the only thing that gives anybody the right to ask for more. Because if you don't go the extra mile, if you're not rendering more service than you're being paid for, then you're being paid for all you render, aren't you? And you haven't a leg to stand on. I remember an office boy by the name of Purdy that once worked for me. Had on short pants, knee pants when he went to work for me. And one day he came in with long pants on, about 6 months after he'd gone to work for us. He shied up to me and he said, Mr. Hill, I'd like to have more money now. What I'm getting is not quite enough. Well, I said, Purdy, what have you done to entitle you to get more money? Well, he said, it's not what I've done so much, but Mr. Hill, I've put on long pants now, and a man wearing long pants is supposed to be getting more than one's wearing short pants. Well, I said, Purdy, that's a very slim reason. Very slim reason for asking for a raise. The point I'm making is that most people who look for advancement or look for favors or look for more pay don't look in the right direction, and they don't create a condition that justifies them in looking, which is the fact that they should start going the extra mile and do it for a sufficient length of time to let the employer know that they intend to keep it up.
The person who benefits from you going the extra mile may not reward you directly, but be assured the reward will come, and it will be definite.
The illustration will show that the reward which came to me for having gone the extra mile was four times removed from the act of rendering the service. The story began 15 years ago when I called on a friend of mine who had just opened a large cafeteria in Atlanta, Georgia, but discovered too late that he had chosen the wrong downtown location, because when the business houses of Atlanta closed, everyone went home and he couldn't get enough dinner tray to support his cafeteria. Because of my longtime friendship with this man, I offered to solve his problem by conducting a series of free success lectures in his cafeteria each evening. This was announced in the newspapers, and we turned away hundreds of people the first night and kept the place filled with guests every night thereafter for several weeks. I made no charge for this service, but I did get my dinner free. Also, I had no intention of gaining any direct benefit from my service because it was a labor of love. A regular attendant at these lectures was an official of a power company who was so impressed by my interpretation of the philosophy that he invited me to address a special meeting of Southern Electrical Power Executives. Now note, this was the first step in the direction of the bountiful reward I was destined to receive for going the extra mile. At the meeting of the Electrical Power Executives, I was introduced to Homer Pace, Vice President of the South Carolina Electric Power Company, who asked me to become acquainted with Dr. William P. Jacobs, a distinguished South Carolina Public Relations Director and President of Presbyterian College of Clinton, South Carolina. I wrote to Dr. Jacobs, and he came to Atlanta to meet me. Now, that was step number two in the direction of my reward. Dr. Jacobs owned a large printing and publishing business, and he invited me to join him in Clinton with the understanding that he would help me when help was needed. I accepted the invitation, and that was step number three in the direction of my reward. After arriving in Clinton, I was invited to become a faculty member of Presbyterian College, and there I gave a series of lectures on the philosophy of success. That was step number four, and the payoff came very dramatically when I became acquainted with one of the students of my class who is now my wife. For it turned out that she has enriched my life in ways which can be evaluated only in terms of spiritual values of a most profound nature. She has brought happiness into my life which could never have been known without her influence. And it all dates back to a service I rendered my friend with no expectation of compensation of any nature whatsoever.
Opportunity generally takes up with the person who first recognizes it. Examine the record of any successful person, and you'll discover that he began with a definite major purpose and carried it through to completion on his own personal initiative.
Not a single one of the 504 men who helped me to build the science of personal achievement was without the active application of this habit of moving on his own personal initiative. And let me give you an illustration of some of the outstanding men who have attained great success by applying this principle along with the other 16 principles of the philosophy. Take Henry J. Kaiser, for instance. During World War II, he was in the business of building ships for the government. And he needed special cars of material to be shipped in from the East. And this material had to be delivered absolutely on time. He didn't take any chances. And in order to make sure that the material would come through on time, he put two expediters on every car material, one to stay awake all the time while the other one slept. And they rode those cars straight across the continent, and they were given instructions that if any railroad man dared to sidetrack those cars, that the expediter should get the president of the railroad company on the telephone immediately and demand that those cars move. That's how definitely that Mr. Kaiser moved in seeing that his personal initiative was carried out. And Orville and Wilbur Wright, for instance, in the development of the airplane, I had the privilege of riding with Orville Wright in the first airplane that the Wright brothers built. They were demonstrating the possibility of planes successful flying to the Navy in Washington. And they chose me as a passenger to ride with Wilbur Wright from Washington down to Alexandria and back 10 miles. And that demonstration made it possible for the Navy to buy one plane. Now, before Orville and Wilbur Wright succeeded in developing this airplane, they failed many times, but they went on their own personal initiative. And Thomas A. Edison in the development of the incandescent electric lamp. Imagine a man, for instance, standing by through 10,000 different failures, as Mr. Edison did, before giving up. His personal initiative was so definite that he told me that if he hadn't found the secret of the incandescent electric lamp, that at that very moment he would be in the laboratory working on it instead of being out there wasting his time talking with me. And then in a more serious note, Mr. Edison said, "You know, I had to succeed, because I finally ran out of things that wouldn't work." And I've thought of that so many times, wondering why more people don't keep on keeping on until they run out of things that won't work, for then they're bound to find the thing that will work. And last but not least, the most important of all, the habit of personal initiative must begin by its application in the small, unimportant circumstances of one's daily life.
The small, unimportant circumstances of life may lead to greatness for those with personal initiative. Witness this story about how one simple act by a young man was his first step to fame and fortune.
It happened one frosty morning when the private railroad car of Charles M. Schwab was shifted to a sidetrack at the steel mill in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. As Mr. Schwab climbed down from the car, he was met by a young man with a stenographer's notebook in his hands, who explained that he was a stenographer in the company's office, and he had come down to meet Mr. Schwab with the hope that he might write any letters or telegrams that the steelmaster would care to send. "Who requested you to meet me here?" Mr. Schwab inquired. "It was my own idea, sir," the young man replied. "I knew you were coming on the early morning train because I handled the telegrams announcing your arrival." Mr. Schwab thanked the young man for his thoughtfulness and said he would call on him later in the day if he needed his services. And he did. When Schwab's private car returned to New York City that night, young Al Williams was aboard. He was transferred at Mr. Schwab's request to the steelmaster's private office in New York. In his new job, young Williams had an opportunity to meet and to become acquainted with many of Mr. Schwab's influential Wall Street bankers and brokers. And through his acquaintanceship, some 5 years later, he was invited to become president of a large wholesale drug company at a fabulous salary and a stock interest in the company.
To reach any goal, self-discipline is essential. Self-discipline causes you to think first and act afterwards. It begins with mastery of your thoughts, and accordingly, your deeds. Self-discipline will give you complete control over your emotions and your physical habits. We begin with the essential items called the Big Four.
The Big Four musts, which must be under control at all times, is number one, the appetite for food and drink, number two, the mental attitude, and number three, the budgeting of time, and number four, definiteness of purpose. Auto-suggestion, which is suggestion which you make to yourself, through dominating thoughts and deeds, is the medium by which self-discipline becomes a habit. And the starting point in the development of self-discipline is definiteness of purpose. Obsessional desire is the dynamo that gives life and action to definiteness of purpose. And be careful what you set your heart upon through obsessional desire, because the subconscious mind goes to work translating that desire into its material equivalent. Self-discipline cannot be attained overnight. It must be developed step by step by the formation of definite habits of thought and action.
I'm going to give you 10 rules for profitable self-discipline. These are rules of my own making. They're very homely, some of them, but they'll be very helpful. And number one is keep cool when other people get hot. I know you can agree with that one, but I'm not so sure that you'll always live up to it. We're inclined, all of us, to get hot when the other fellow gets hot. Say angry things when the other fellow starts saying angry things. I was in the home of the president of a big electric power company one evening when there came a storm, and he called up one of his head men to go out to take care of an emergency that happened as a result of that storm. It was on Sunday evening. The man was gone about 2 hours, and when he came back, he came up on the front porch of the home of this man and called him out on the porch, and I never heard a man get such a tongue-lashing in all my life as this president of the electric power company gets. Says, you blankety-blank-blank, you think because you're the president of the company, blankety-blank-blank, and I'm just as good as you are, blankety-blank-blank. Oh, it was terrific. I only heard one side of the conversation because there was only one side of it. One man was doing all the talking, and one man was doing all the listening. And after this had been going on for fully 3 minutes, the other man ran out of wind and had nothing more to say. He was mad, you see, because they'd called him out on this stormy night. I heard the president close the door and he came back and he just smiled and said, why, the man was a little bit hot, wasn't he? That's all he said. A little bit hot, wasn't he? I expected any moment to hear a fist begin to fly out there. But you see, there was a man who had risen to great heights of achievement financially, and he had done it by self-discipline. Self-discipline in every respect. And he didn't propose to allow a workman who had been temporarily unbalanced by his anger to throw him off balance and make him stoop to that level. He just didn't propose to have that done. And you'll notice when you get into an argument with anyone, and you're apt to if you don't watch yourself, that if you'll just remain silent while the other fellow's blowing off his top, he finally gets to the point where he's got no more top to blow off. Then if you want to get in a few words of your own, that's a mighty good place to do it. It's a mighty fine thing if the words that you get in are not the kind of the words you've been hearing. In other words, if you say something back kind in return, it's far better for the other fellow and far better for you. It shows you to be the bigger of the two persons. Now, anybody can get mad and blow his top because of what somebody does or says, and that's happening all the time. But the truly big man, the man who is in charge of himself, he doesn't allow anybody to draw him down to that level of a street brawl or of an argument in harsh words unless he wants to do it. And if he's truly a big man, he doesn't want to do it. Number two, remember there are three sides to all arguments. We ordinarily think there are two sides to all arguments, but they're not, they're three. There's your side, there's the other fellow's side, and then there's the right side, which is usually about in the middle of the two viewpoints. Remember that when you get into an argument with the other fellow. Don't assume that he's always at fault. Maybe you're partly at fault too. Maybe neither one is totally at fault. The chances are, in all of the arguments I've ever heard, both parties were partly to blame in one way or another. I have never yet heard an argument where one party entirely was to blame, although I suspect there are such arguments at times. Number three, never give directives to a subordinate when you're angry. If the matter is urgent, then cool off quickly. Number four, treat all people as nearly as possible as if they were rich relatives from whom you expected to be remembered in their will. Now, that's a good one. That's a honey. That is a honey. If you just do that, treat all people as if they were rich relatives from whom you expected to inherit something at their death. And you can do that. You know, if you had a rich relative that had $1 million he was going to leave to you, or you suspected he was going to, it wouldn't make very much difference what he said or did. He would never throw you off balance. You'd never talk back to him, would you? Of course you wouldn't. You'd be quite silly if you did. Keeping quiet for $1 million seems to me to be a very easy price to pay. Number five, look for the seed of an equivalent benefit in every unpleasant circumstance with which you meet, no matter what the unpleasant circumstance is. Make it a point to discipline yourself so that you look for that seed of an equivalent benefit and you start looking in connection with the circumstance. Start right in where you stand. It'll lessen the blow. It'll lessen the hurt of the wound, whatever it happens to be, if you start looking for that seed of an equivalent benefit. And number six, learn the almost forgotten art of asking questions and then listening to the answers instead of getting the other fellow told off. It gives you an awful lot of satisfaction when you're angry to get the other fellow told, doesn't it? And the temptation is very great to do that. I know, because I've been there many times. Don't do it. Be bigger than that. Listen to what the other fellow has to say. And then when somebody makes a statement that you're not sure about, learn to ask this one question. It's one of the most important questions in life. It'll serve more purposes than any other short question that I can think of. When somebody makes a statement that you're not sure about, or that you doubt, or that you question, ask a four-word question. How do you know? And then wait for an answer and see him squirm. Oftentimes there is no answer. People make wild statements that they can't back up. And instead of getting into an argument and making an incident out of the matter and getting yourself worked up into an argument, let the other fellow stew in his own fat by putting him over the barrel with that question, how do you know? I had a clergyman in my class once who was very, I just don't know exactly how to describe him. He was a fanatic, you might say, on the subject of religion. And he was sure that he knew exactly what was going to happen to me after death. He said so in no uncertain terms, not in the class, but in a private conversation. And he raved and ranted for quite a little while about it. And when he got through, I said, how do you know, Parson? And that really put him over the barrel. He said, that's the way I feel about it. That's my faith. I said, well, now, having belief and faith is one thing, but having evidence is something else again. How do you know what's going to happen to me after I die? I don't know, and I doubt that you do. How do you know? Well, he never did give me a satisfactory answer. There are a lot of questions that come up in life in connection with which, if you ask that one thing, how do you know, you'll find that the other fellow will be off balance, and you don't need to make an incident out of what he says. You don't need to get mad at what he says. 7, never say or do anything which may influence another person without first asking yourself this question. Will it benefit him or hurt him? And if it will hurt him, don't do it. Don't say anything or do anything that would hurt another person under any circumstances, no matter how much he may deserve it. Exercise self-discipline. Don't do that, because if you hurt another man, you're going to hurt yourself 10 times as much at least. Because that hurt will come back on you. I don't care who you are nor what circumstances you're working under or living under. If you hurt another person, you will be hurt 10 times as much. And if the hurt doesn't come immediately, the rate of interest on that is compound interest on compound interest. And it'll be 100 times as great if you wait long enough. Because everything that you do to or for another person, you do to or for yourself. There is no escape from that. That's just as much a law as the law of gravitation, which everyone understands. You know that if you stepped over the top of this building, no matter what your mind was or what your belief happened to be, if you stepped over the top of this building and violated the law of gravitation, that you'd hit the ground and you'd die in a very few seconds. And this law, which brings you back that which you send out, is just as inevitable, just as inexorable as the law of gravitation or any other of nature's laws. 8, learn the difference between friendly analysis and unfriendly criticism. Then decide which you wish to live by in your relations with others. Now, friendly analysis is one thing and is welcomed by most sensible people. I don't object to friendly analysis of anything that I do, even though it's very unfavorable. If it's friendly analysis, I like it, because I can improve by it. But if it's unfriendly criticism, very obviously unfriendly criticism and not analysis, why then I resent it. I wouldn't be human if I didn't. How can I tell whether it's friendly analysis or unfriendly criticism? How would you go about telling? There are a lot of ways you can tell. You can tell by your relationship to the person who's making it, whether it's friendly or unfriendly to begin with. If it's an enemy, obviously I discount it right off the bat, because you almost know it's going to be unfriendly criticism. I can tell also by the tone of voice in which he does it, by the manner in which he does it. Because a man who engages in unfriendly criticism generally uses a few epithets along with it that clearly indicates that he's biased. If you have self-discipline, you're not going to be influenced by that kind of a person. And 9, remember that a good leader in any calling is one who can take orders as cheerfully as he gives them. And 10, last but not least, remember that tolerance in human relations is just as important as tolerance in the operation of mechanics. I want to give you some examples of what lack of self-discipline can do. I come from down in Virginia, and our adjoining sister state is West Virginia, where my sons now live. And we know the Hatfields and the McCoys on both sides. I've known them back down through the years. Several generations ago, one of the Hatfields' boar pigs got over in one of the McCoys' cornfields, and the McCoy sat his dog on the pig and tore his ear off. pig wasn't worth over $1.50 at that time at the most. But they started shooting one another at sight over that pig, and I don't know how many Hatfields and how many McCoys have been killed, but it's been quite a number. And they kept that up for two generations. Killing one another at sight over a boar pig worth $1.50. You know, somewhere along there, somebody failed to use self-discipline. A lot of it. The idea of killing a man over a hog, or killing a man for any reason, for that matter. It started that feud and became famous all over the country, and I haven't the slightest doubt what every one of you has heard of the Hatfields and the McCoys. No imaginary feud, it was a real one. Now, the habit of making an incident out of petty annoyances is one of the things that most of us indulge in very greatly to our detriment almost every day of our lives. Making an incident out of petty annoyances, allowing it to become an incident instead of just winking at it or looking in the other direction or keeping silent. The man who exercises self-discipline doesn't allow anybody else to make an incident that he doesn't want to occur. Life is filled with unpleasant things that one must deal with. Never fan the fire of an unpleasant incident into the white heat of an argument. You can always avoid it if you try. You know, a very small incident can start a feud just like the Hatfield-McCoy feud that lasts down through the years and destroys your appetite. It gives you stomach ulcers, gives you headaches, causes your teeth to decay sooner than they would otherwise. And the Lord only knows what other things it does to you. Allowing a little insignificant incident to upset you, disturb you, and throw you off balance. Don't do it. You don't have to do it. Be more dignified than that. Be more becoming. Be more appreciative of that great prerogative that the Creator gave you, that is, the ability to control your own mind and to make it whatever you want it to be.